Take a network break, grab a virtual donut, and listen to our stories on Let's Encrypt, Microsoft, Mellanox, Cumulus, and more. Let's do a little business first. Today's show is sponsored by ThousandEyes. ThousandEyes gives you performance visibility from every user to every app over any network, internal and external, so you can migrate to the cloud, troubleshoot faster, and deliver an exceptional user experience. You can get a free account at ThousandEyes.com/packetpushers and a free t-shirt. And speaking of ThousandEyes, stay tuned after the news. We've got a sponsored Tech Bytes conversation with ThousandEyes about getting performance visibility all the way to the end user device with its endpoint agent. It measures device performance with real-time application session data or synthetic transactions, so stick around for that conversation. And last but not least, we haven't mentioned in a while, but we've got a professional development site. It's called Ignition. We've been adding new instructional material, including a video course on data center fabrics from Russ White, an Ansible for networking training course, and we're going to be very soon publishing a buyer's guide on service meshes. It's just $99 a year, and that gets you access to all of that, plus more, including a lot of web white papers you've been working on, Greg.
Yeah, I've been. I must admit that I'm not as diligent as I need to be. There's too much going on at the moment. All this, you know, the things happening in society, and seeing we're being our schedules are being messed around by conferences being cancelled and calls changing and all that sort of stuff.
Yes, yes.
So it is a little bit of a problem at the moment, but I'm still working on several that sort of a lot of the ideas that I bring up here I actually work through in white papers. So that I'm not just shooting off my mouth. There's actually quite a bit of thought behind them. So even if it sounds like I'm just shooting off my mouth, it usually I've tried to spend a lot of time thinking about it and researching it before I the ideas aren't just sprung fully formed, if you like.
And yes.
So a lot of those white papers that I'm trying to get published and have published reflect that, the thinking that gets you to where that is. If that's helpful to you, then maybe it's worth spending your, you know, $100 of your employer's money.
Yep, go to ignition.packetpushers.net. You can see everything that's there, and if you like it, sign up. And if not, no worries, we'll get you next time.
Exactly.
All right, let's talk about some news. What a difference a week makes. In our last show, we reported that Let's Encrypt, which provides free website certificates to enable TLS, had issued its billionth cert. Now the nonprofit has announced it has had to revoke more than 3 million certificates due to a bug in how the certs were issued.
Yeah, this was obviously it was great to see Let's Encrypt come along, and I, you know, were full of glowing praise last week, a billion certificates, you know, so forth and so on. But the challenge here is they've had a bug, and they've wanted to rescind or revoke 3 million certificates. The problem that I had with this is it's not the fact that the certificates have to be revoked. It's good, very public disclosure, lots of discussion. But every time I went to look it up and check what the status of this was, there was nothing on their website.
There's nothing on the homepage, yeah.
Yeah, right? Like, they have a blog site. There's not a blog post there. It's just buried down in the community forums somewhere.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Is the developers writing this stuff, which is actually should have been, like, formalized up. So I'm a little bit sort of – I think I went three times this week to look it up, and I'm going, like, well, why is there nothing on the website? There's nothing on the website to say that this is a problem, you know? And then all of a sudden it starts – you start following the links, and then you go, like, oh, okay, they're announcing it on Twitter, not on the website. Which, anyway, I'm being whiny.
Yeah. No, I don't think you're being whiny at all. Having to revoke and get new certs is an issue for network domain admins. They need to be able to be aware of it. And for a company like Let's Encrypt that tends to be very public about what it's doing, obviously, you know, they're not hiding it. It's, you can find it online. But yeah, there should be at least something on the homepage saying, hey, by the way, you may want to check this list of revoked certs to see if you need to be working on this.
Mm, yeah. Anyway, it's not too bad. The good part about Let's Encrypt is that you do have to refresh your certificates every 90 days, and there's a whole command line. It's a very short command line to just renew the certificate. So it's not a huge pain to fix. It's not like, you know, you've got a branded a vendor router and you have to go through some arcane process to upload code and reboot to go, you know, all this sort of stuff. It's just a refresh the certificate and they'll issue you a new one. And if you just renew the certificate, you'll pretty much be all right. But then they got to a certain point through the cycle. They said, we're going to, you know, revoke all the certificates. I think, what, today? Was it today? Yes.
I think it was the 5th. They said
yesterday
was their deadline. Yeah. And then they extended it.
Yeah. So people haven't done it. They said there's still a million certificates out there. So they're holding off until it gets a bit closer to completion in case it causes people some problems. Yeah.
That's right. So if you wonder whether you need to get a new cert, we've got links in the show notes where you can find it, or just hit Let's Encrypt and look on their community blog to find that link.
Yeah, don't look at their website. You have to go to community.letsencrypt.org where there's some sort of forum software that nobody reads unless you're particularly into that thing. Yeah,
that's right. All right, moving on. Microsoft has announced, but not yet released, a forthcoming option for Windows servers and clients that will let you run the SMB protocol to access file shares over QUIC. QUIC is a transport protocol that uses UDP instead of TCP and supports TLS 1.3 to encrypt the connection.
And I can't believe I'm reading this. Yeah, the reason that we block port 445, Drew, is...
It's insecure. Yeah, you don't want SMB. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Well, SMB protocol was insecure, so we don't expose it to the internet. It was never authenticated. Yeah. It was unsafe. Notably, that no point in this does Microsoft actually talk about making SMB secure or authenticated. So changing the protocol that it runs over so people can use it over the internet. So QUIC, of course, is a form of HTTP these days. So HTTP over UDP, QUIC, is basically just bypassing the firewalls, which are there for very good reasons. One, can't trust Microsoft to do something secure. Two, we don't want people transferring files outside of the firewall unless we deliberately allow it. And three, is this really something that we want? Who asked for this? Did you ask for this?
I did not ask for this, no. Apparently, Microsoft thinks there are lots of remote workers and hot desk workers and traveling sales folks or whatever who need access to file shares in the cloud or back at corporate who don't want to mess around with a VPN and maybe will appreciate this. But yeah, switching ports to 443, which is always open, isn't necessarily a great sign.
No, I think it's going to cause a lot of problems, and I think there'll be mistakes and data leaks and... I understand that in principle, the world wants to get rid of all these legacy protocols and the domination of HTTPS for everything using TLS 1.3. And let's just get away from the whole, you know, seven layer model. And we'll throw that out the door. We're just going to run everything over QUIC going forward. That seems to be real, right? You're going to see the whole idea of IP, TCP, you know, and the stack layers all the way up to the app. That's all just being replaced with QUIC. And it is going to be something going forward that your idea of a firewall blocking TCP ports or UDP ports is going to become largely pointless. It's going to be an application inspection or nothing to be useful.
So, well, absolutely, yeah. That's why we've seen quote-unquote next-generation firewalls emerge to do that application inspection and ID because of so much going over HTTP ports that if they're open, it doesn't matter with a stateful firewall if you can't see what's inside that traffic, yeah.
Yeah, stateful firewalls are over. The next generation is application recognition. And there are various, if you want to build your own, by the way, there are various public libraries out there like JA3 that actually do projects, which is for creating client fingerprints, so you can actually fingerprint sessions. So if you're interested in finding out more, go and have a look at that.
I did read the blog about Microsoft announcing this, and I noticed that they do highlight, and literally actually highlight in there, that this is an opt-in feature that you can set up. It's not going to be thrust upon you. So I think this is a sort of a tacit acknowledgement from Microsoft that this may be a little bit dodgy for some folks. So
they aren't going to force you to do it. They say that now.
Well, we've got it in writing.
Let's just say that the gap between reality and theory is pretty big sometimes.
Yes, there's your cynicism coming out.
That's the harsh voice of experience and being, you know, having my life, personal life destroyed out of hours because of vendors saying one thing and doing another 2 months later.
Yes. All right, we'll leave that there and come back to it if we need to. Let's move on. Cisco and Google are offering free licenses for their collaboration suites to organizations who are dealing with the effects of coronavirus, meaning having employees work from home or having to work remotely. Cisco is offering a 90-day license of WebEx with unlimited usage for up to 100 clients. And on the Google side, if you're already an existing G Suite or G Suite for Education customer, Google's going to provide free access to advanced Hangout Meet video conferencing, which supports up to 250 participants on a call and live streaming for 10,000 viewers. And Google's offer is available until the 1st of July, 2020.
This is great in the sense that Google and Cisco have these collaboration tools and making them available to people is desirable. I'll also point out that this is a fantastic sales exercise. So if you were cynically inclined, such as I am, you couldn't help but wonder if Cisco's not seeing this as a fantastic opportunity to get inside organizations which previously they couldn't even remotely talk to before.
Yes.
It's a bit of a disappointment, though, that this week Cisco announced a number of high-severity vulnerabilities in WebEx. Like, basically, you know, I've been banging on about how WebEx is unsafe and unfit for purpose. And yet again this week, another 2.7.8 on the CVSS score vulnerabilities on WebEx. So my strong recommendation is to use neither Cisco or Google Hangouts, both of which are utter trash. as somebody who's been using these remote access apps for over 8 years, I promise you that they are trash. The only one that works is Zoom. So go and use that, and they also have a good deal going for people who are starting out on the remote access for the first time.
Yep. Yeah, I agree. Tip of the hat for the companies to extend a free license for a limited time, given the situation we're in. But yes, they also have potential upside benefits for those organizations. Yeah. So it's it's a give and a take.
Honestly, I won't. If you schedule a meeting with me on Google Hangouts, the answer will be no. There's no meeting worth having that involves Google Hangouts, and WebEx is a very close second. I actually, if I don't want to have your meeting and you send me a WebEx invitation, I'll probably just say no because life's too short to hang out on software that doesn't work, and that's been my experience of those two products consistently year in, year out for quite some period of time.
We did just have a bad WebEx Hangout meeting the other day, so yeah.
Yeah, just crashed all the time repeatedly over and over. Got better things to do.
All right, back to Microsoft for a moment then. The company's announcing it's going to continue to pay the full salaries of all hourly workers on Microsoft facilities in the Puget Sound region in Northern California. That includes folks like cafe workers, shuttle drivers, and other on-site jobs. Full pay is being provided even if those workers have reduced work hours due to a smaller number of tech employees actually coming to campus sites because of coronavirus and COVID-19 and companies urging workers to work from home. This is, I think, sort of the flip side of what we saw from Google and Cisco offering free licensing. This is Microsoft actually paying folks who may not actually have to show up for their job because they realize these are low-wage employees who could be materially impacted by slowdowns at work at campus facilities. I think this is great. This is actually a legitimately good thing for this multi-billion-dollar tech company to be doing.
It's also something that shouldn't have happened in the first place. Like, even if you're a low-salary worker, your employer should be giving you rights and privileges associated with normal employment. And this type of stuff, this hourly worker stuff, actually reminds me of the Industrial Revolution in the 1700s, where they would take people off the farms, and if they turned up to work, they got paid, and if they didn't, they didn't get paid.
Yep.
And ultimately, that sort of approach to handling workers in that era actually led to societal problems of a substantial scale. Things like uncontrolled disease outbreaks in cities, people couldn't feed themselves or look after themselves. And then the nobilities decided that they would start looking after the poor and stuff like that. And that's what this is. This is literally
a This is noblesse oblige, yes.
Yeah, this is noblesse oblige. We don't have to do this. We're doing it for your own good. We're also doing it for our own good because we don't want you coming in and transmitting plague into our, right? So I don't see this as a good thing. I see this as embarrassing that this should even be a discussion point, and people should not be lauding Microsoft for this. This is the least they could do.
In some way, and I actually feel like it would be great to see companies like Microsoft cover things like sick leave and healthcare benefits for these workers who, as you mentioned, are often subcontractors. They probably don't have the same benefits as full-time employees like software developers and marketing folks. A lot of these companies like Microsoft will subcontract with organizations to staff like cafes and shuttle drivers and all that stuff. So,
with the deliberate intention of exploiting workers and getting paid.
Absolutely. And these are workers who are working hourly jobs in really expensive regions, Northern California, Puget Sound, very expensive to live there. So, I'm glad Microsoft is doing this. I hope other tech companies follow up on it. But yes, this whole subcontracting and low hourly workers, it does smack of noblesse oblige.
Doesn't it? Not going to belabor the politics. Let's move on.
All right. A quick break to tell you about our sponsor, ThousandEyes. They help organizations deliver business-critical service by providing performance visibility and actionable intelligence from every user over any network to every app, including Office 365 and Salesforce. They've got cloud agents, enterprise agents, and endpoint agents to gather unique insights on network behavior and topologies and how they affect application performance. With ThousandEyes, you can generate performance data through active monitoring techniques from global vantage points, quickly pinpoint root cause of device faults, congestion, Wi-Fi quality, DDoS attacks, and more. You can share event dashboards, metrics, and visualizations with your vendors and partners to work together to resolve problems faster. Here's a special offer for you, our listener. Sign up for a free account at thousandeyes.com/packetpushers. That's thousandeyes.com/packetpushers. Get a free account and choose a free t-shirt while you're there. All right, back to the news and sticking with coronavirus. The county of Santa Clara in California, which is home to some of the world's biggest tech companies, is asking these companies to cancel employee travel and postpone or cancel large event. Santa Clara County includes the cities of Cupertino, San Jose, Mountain View, and Palo Alto. So that's covering companies like Apple, Google, Facebook, Cisco, and others.
Yeah, this makes sense. You don't want – the tech industry is very wealthy and obviously able to send people all over the world. And I imagine the local government saying, please don't send your workers out and then get them bringing back the COVID virus.
Yes.
That's pretty straightforward. So it also has to be said that most of the tech companies have already fairly proactively done it. However, I noticed that still 20% of events are still happening in San Francisco even today.
Yeah, it's interesting. So you and I were supposed to go to Aruba Atmosphere that was coming up at the end of March. That got canceled. They're going to move to a virtual event. There's a big show in Austin, Texas called South by Southwest that attracts a large tech presence. I've seen some big tech companies like Apple and Facebook say they aren't attending, but the show itself is still going on. So yeah, very interesting on how different organizations are approaching this live event conundrum.
Yeah. Well, the whole discussion around live events and all that sort of stuff, and I mean, we're tentatively maybe going to Cisco Live, which is at the end of May, which is, you know, as we speak, is nearly 10 to 12 weeks away. So maybe it's a bit early to see it cancelled, but I suspect my gut feel tells me that Cisco Live will be cancelled. This isn't a month or two before things get on the balance. This is going to be months and months.
Yeah.
Is my instinct, rightly or wrongly, I'm not a medical professional. I'm not pretending to be. It's just you have to make an assessment, and that is my assessment for myself personally. But it's going to be interesting to speculate if conferences come back. And we talked a little bit about this last week, but I've come up with another angle on this. And if I'm going to be somebody, if I'm a big tech company and I'm going to a conference and I've spent $1 million on a booth, or and that is not an unrealistic number, by the way, or even a small booth at a conference is still $75,000, $150,000. These conferences are often the biggest marketing spend that they will undergo. They're now going to want to demand contracts that have refunds if the conference is canceled by the organizer for any reason.
Yes, yes.
And I'm betting that conference organizers can't afford to do that because they have fixed outlays. So when you book a hotel, for example, that booking blocks off that space, and the hotel's not going to be able to say, oh, yeah, no, we'll give you a refund if you cancel because
right? Because they couldn't sell that hotel because you blocked it, yes.
That's right. Once it's blocked, the product is sold, you can't get, you know, maybe you can get 50% back or something or some sort of thing like that. So I think the challenge is going to be here is if there's a lot of companies out there, events companies, that run events for profit all over the world, and if the vendors now go to them and say, well, we want to know what our refund policy is, and we expect to get a refund if you cancel it for whatever reason, right? And if that, however that looks, and maybe even if it's only half a refund or something like that, then a lot of the for-profit conferences could disappear. This would be speculation. And you end up with only conferences that might be left as a secondary and a much more undesirable income. The only conferences that are left are the ones sponsored by big companies who don't actually have a single profit motive. A big reason for Cisco Live and Aruba Atmosphere is for sales and marketing to occur.
And yes.
While these conferences do make a profit, it's not the only reason that they exist. That makes sense.
No, absolutely. It's definitely a marketing event. It's a sales event. It's also sort of we're big enough to have our own show kind of branding exercise, essentially.
Yeah, sometimes these conferences are ego exercises by big companies. There's certainly an aspect of that. But I just wonder what's going to happen. Like, we've got companies out there I'm thinking of Imperva, who runs 800 conferences a year. Mm-hmm. Imagine if all the vendors that go to that company's conferences expect to get refunds or demand refunds as a condition of signing up.
Right.
What happens to those conferences? Those conferences will get unprofitable or become highly risky, and that will affect their share price. So it's going to be interesting to see if they come back. I suspect they will, but we'll see a lot less conferences going forward.
I assume that the big vendor branded shows will return because there are many reasons for those to operate. But yes, the impact on for-profit conference hosting companies could be significant.
Yeah, like MPLS and SDN World in Europe, that happens every year. Or, you know, they're strictly run by events companies, and the intention is to make a profit. All the speakers, you know, come and talk for free, which makes them pretty second rate, in my opinion. Nobody's talking real. They're all paid to talk, basically. They all spent money to get on stage. I think a lot of those conferences would just disappear, and we'll see a new landscape. Now, that said, there's a lot of virtual conferences being offered, and I'm making plans to have virtual audiences. So if there are virtual events out there, one of the great things about the virtual events is that you can sit with people in the row and mutter to each other, oh, that's bullshit, you know. Well, that's quite good. Well, I quite like, you know, that sort of stuff. So yes. I'm going to be organizing those from the Packet Pusher Slack channel, and I'm going to be saying, you know, join me in a Zoom room. We'll have up to 100 people, and we can sit there and chatter in the background, and we can watch them together. If anybody's interested in doing that, make sure you get over to the Packet Pusher Slack channel. You can sign up for it at packetpushers.net/slack, and we can have a lot of fun poking fun at the presentations and so forth and so on.
Yeah, the side conversation snark is my favorite, one of my favorite parts of a live event. So doing that virtually just warms my heart.
Sure. It could be good fun. And it's also very, you know, and that could also let us be interactive. We will be careful not to let people get out of hand and slagging off the speakers and everything. But
well, the other thing is that you never know who's going to have an interesting insider comment that you hadn't considered in these sort of sidebar conversations as well. So, yeah, they can be valuable.
Yeah, and it could be good fun, you know, a way of building a virtual, you know, sit in an audience with 20 or 30 people of like-minded who care about this sort of stuff. So, yeah.
And you don't have to worry about people sneezing on you.
No, or even seeing you. You can be wearing pants or not.
Pants optional. It's the only pants optional conference.
I suspect my attendance will be very gin-powered because they quite often happen at a...
There's another benefit.
Yes.
All right, well, check out packetpushers.net/slack if you'd like to get on our Slack channel and maybe participate in one of these virtual events coming up. Let's get back to some news. Verizon, Ciena, and Juniper partnered on a test that sent 800 gigabits per second of data on a single wavelength in a fiber optic network. Prior to this test, multiple wavelengths had to be combined to get 800 gigabits per second. This is a quote from Juniper. The test traffic was transmitted between two Juniper network QFX 5220 packet platforms across two Ciena 6500 platforms powered by a WaveLogic 5 coherent optics.
This is quite a coup for Ciena, in my opinion. They are well ahead of their competitors in the 800 gig space. And we're seeing the reason that Juniper is important in this test is that they've got 400 gig optics. So they're Silicon Photonics. They recently made an acquisition to buy a Silicon Photonics company. They've got 400 gig. They're producing switches that are capable of routing at 400 gigabits per second. So you can feed 800 gigabit per second lambdas. And it's just mind-boggling that you can get 800 gigabits per second on a single lambda. Now, yeah. I don't know how many lambdas you can get on a single fiber, but these coherent optics that Ciena is punching out is fantastic. Because they're just a couple of weeks ago, in March the 3rd, they were 3 days ago, they were talking about pumping a single carrier 400 gig wavelength with a 2,100 kilometer span between Chicago and Denver. So think about that. All of a sudden, we're shipping 400 gig wavelengths over 2,100 kilometers with no repeaters. That's just that was just fantastic, right?
Yeah, so, that's great.
This is quadruple the capacity of what was previously possible, and it only requires a single set of electro-optics. So I think that means only one transmitter set. They might need, whether they're talking about having an erbium-doped amplifier in the middle to signify it, just the once, I'm not sure, but still. 400 gig, that's really important to us as networking professionals because the more bandwidth there is in the underlay, the better everything else gets, but particularly SD-WAN, and it's going to be exciting.
Yep. Links in the show notes if you want to get more details, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's worth quickly flipping over it, yeah.
And you also just did a DWDM podcast.
Yeah.
Heavy networking.
Yeah. I got dragged into a consulting project to do some DWDM analysis. And as part of that, I spoke to a whole bunch of people. And then, of course, I did a podcast on it to sort of share some of my learnings and to learn stuff. We spoke to the guys over at ESNet who run a DWDM ring. And it's been fairly popular. And I think people have actually reacted to that, sometimes a little bit hostile, because they don't see the same things that I'm seeing. But I'm having a robust discussion, putting my point of view forward in the Slack channel once again, yeah.
All right, well, that link will also be in the show notes if you want to take a listen.
Yeah.
Moving on, Mellanox, they've announced it will acquire Titan IC. This is a privately held company in Ireland that makes acceleration hardware to speed pattern matching and traffic inspection. The acquisition price was not disclosed.
Oh, it's not Ireland. It's Northern Ireland.
Sorry. Northern Ireland. Yes, I do have to be very... I apologize. It's
your geography needs to be done. No, it was a Northern Ireland.
My political geography.
Not that that matters. Very interesting acquisition, really. Titan IC is an existing partner of Mellanox. I think they've been feeding or designing chipsets, which then Mellanox has been building into or accompanying their Bluefield system on a chip, which goes onto the NIC. The Titan IC can process complex data strings consisting of many rules of analysis, and it's mainly intended to secure cloud servers that handle advanced data analytics and search applications. So what they're saying here is that this is a particular type of processor where you can hand off pattern matching and it will process it. So this conceptually, this technology is similar to what a TPU or a GPU, so a graphics processor unit, is used to render graphics displays or compute blockchains. TPUs are used for artificial intelligence type stuff, TensorFlow processor units. And what we're seeing is that the NIC is becoming also a capability for outboarding or handling off processing of the CPU. Mm-hmm. So Mellanox is making a big deal about the fact that its smart NIC technology is now able to do accelerated network I/O, but also able to do advanced storage processing. So you can actually push the storage primitives, the NVMe storage primitives straight and RDMA primitives directly into it, and it will process it on its own. So this continues a trend of, you know, there are offloads. The CPU is now a bottleneck inside of servers, and we're now looking for ways to extend the performance of your server farms in particular. Now, the one other thing that these smart NICs are now doing is they also act as baseboard management controllers, or they actually protect the servers. Because the CPUs and the memory that's on them is custom designed, they actually act as security engines for servers. So if you're in the cloud and you're selling bare metal servers, you don't want people taking them over and doing insecure things or unsafe things and, you know, breaking out of the network isolation that you get them in or change routing them. And these NICs are becoming the security point. So a hardware root of trust, software root of trust, and they also validate. They also sort of act as like a computer within a computer type stuff. So it's very interesting to see the rise of NICs as processors and becoming computers in their own right, handling a lot of offload, but also acting as security functions. And Mellanox is still working through its acquisition by NVIDIA. It was a takeover was announced, I think, sort of Q3 last year, and it's currently still working its way through. But that doesn't seem to have stopped them from continuing to grow the business. So if you've got that sort of need, go out there and have a look at the smart NICs. Mellanox isn't the only one doing this. All of the smart NICs players are doing it. And see what maybe there's something in there that can help you accelerate your servers.
That's right. All right, an entry into our space networking coverage. A large Chinese holding company called Geely has announced it's investing in a new manufacturing plant to build satellites for self-driving car networks to provide navigation services and internet connectivity.
So why would a car company want to build a satellite network is the question that sort of stands out from this, and that's why we're discussing it here. It turns out Geely is a Chinese company, manufacturer of many things, like it makes many different products. But
it's a holding company for a whole bunch of businesses, yes.
That's right. But some of its biggest manufacturing business are electric cars, also electric buses, trains, and drones. And it's now announced that it's going to spend $369 million building satellites with the stated goal of supporting their electric cars. They're sort of like a CubeSat, so they're very small, very not big, heavy satellites like we've seen in years gone by. These are much more like the Starlink things. And that leads me to the sort of conclusion that SpaceX, Starlink, Tesla has got the same sort of thing.
Yeah.
And Geely seems to be walking down the same path in that if I've got cars, I need a network for them, and I don't seem to want to do business with the existing 5G network providers, so I'll build my own. Which seems bonkers, right?
Well, I mean, I guess I don't want to get too paranoid, but thinking about China wanting to control its own destiny in regard to the internet and connectivity, maybe having a essentially Chinese network of satellites to control literal mobile devices, cars, drones, whatever, sort of makes sense. There may be an opportunity here.
Yes, and I think that would be – I think the flip side of this, of course, is that we're now seeing – satellite making, which was once the province of very specialized niche companies that could, you know, had these specialist skills about making satellites, and yet now we have companies like Starlink coming out of nowhere to make satellite technology in just a few years, which is quite amazing, I think. And it's that commoditization of technology, how it goes from rare and unusual to mainstream to commodity. Anybody can basically make one. And it's going to be very interesting to see how this works out, because if car companies are going to build satellite networks as part of their thing, where does that leave General Motors and BMW Corporation? You know, should they be building satellites? Interesting speculation. Anyway, in the meantime, for us as networking professionals, the idea of satellite networks being everyday and common seem to have taken a step forward.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, there's at this point, it's still mostly talk, but if these plans come through, there's going to be a lot of satellites up in low Earth orbit, a lot of networking that has to happen, and not to mention a lot of satellite operations.
That's right. It's just fascinating. Like, you know, SpaceX has dropped the cost of a launch down to about $70 to $90 million a launch. And if you can put 60 satellites into there, well, then all of a sudden, the game kind of changes a little bit.
Yep,
and
for sure.
China's got these rockets, so it probably wants to have this cycle of, if I build a rocket, can I have payloads? And so, yes, I think there's a change in – there's a whole dynamic there, but that's not for us. For me, it just the key thing is satellite networks, normal, not – you know, you look at Starlink and you think that's a one-off, right? No, this would suggest that Starlink is just everyday behavior.
You too could have a career in space networking.
So it would seem.
All right. Moving on, Cumulus Networks has announced a new software package of Ansible playbooks and Jinja 2 templates that are coming pre-populated to help their customers deploy new pods of Cumulus gear. The idea is that once you rack and wire the switches, you can run these playbooks to drive configuration and provisioning of the network. Cumulus is also making the software bundles available under an open source license, so they want to take advantage of the community. People can grab it, modify it, share it, share changes back, etc. It's also a way for Cumulus to help customers get comfortable with automation tools like Ansible and get accustomed to CI continuous integration practices.
This is really interesting, and Cumulus has done a wonderful things for networking by contributing to open source projects and changing networking, like FRR, free range routing particularly, which was started by then, has had an enormous impact on the open networking movement. As you know, this is a absolutely top-end routing protocol suite that everybody's using now, and often better than the commercial products that we're getting from vendors. And definitely people are using it in places where you wouldn't expect. But this is not only network automation, but network testing. So it completely validates and tests your configurations in the continuous integration pipeline. So if you decide to commit a change, these Ansible playbooks will actually run a series of tests to make sure that this configuration is valid before it actually punches it into the network configuration. So,
yeah, Cumulus has a system where you can do this in the cloud, running sort of spun up virtual Cumulus devices to test a configuration and test changes, or you can run that same VM on premises if you want to do it. Yeah, so it's also a validation tool, yes.
Yeah, but this is the thing that's really interesting to me, is it's always been, in my view, about how do we prove that our network's going to work? How do we know that this change is going to give us what we wanted? And I've talked many times over the years about how do we test and validate? And one of the things that the IETF, I think, you know, I used to talk years ago about the test, is that the IETF should have a test suite against OSPF protocols to say, if you meet this, your OSPF is ready, fit for purpose. But they don't, right? And this is a step in that direction, though.
Yeah, and I also think one of the value propositions that Cumulus came to market with is that, hey, our network OS is Linux-based, so you can manage it like you would manage Linux servers, fleets of Linux servers, but they've had to sort of help train or encourage the networking community to get on board with that kind of that high automation touch that you can get with that Linux model. So this
is
another
step.
Well,
yeah, he said that so well. So many people are used to a proprietary CLI with some arcane set of commands that were invented 30 years ago but never really overhauled. It does make the idea of using Linux and the Linux command set does make sense overall, but you've got to have the right perspective. And so, you know, Cumulus is solving its own problem here. They wouldn't give it away if they didn't feel there was value in giving it away.
Absolutely, and there's always folks hoping to extract value from the community itself by getting some free development, so there's that as well.
Also has to be said, it probably didn't take a lot of work to do this.
Well, like, I spoke with them. They said they've been using this software package themselves in their professional services engagements with customers, so they feel like it's pretty well baked, and then they're happy to let the community run with it.
Yeah, what I'm saying is it probably didn't take 40 developers in a team 6 months to write.
I'm guessing not. Yes.
But that's my point is, you know, some of these tools you can actually – and there's no point in not giving this away, because if it encourages more people to buy Cumulus you know, the VXOS that goes in on their switches, then this is absolutely where you want to be.
Yeah, and the other goal they have here is that essentially what they're trying to encourage is folks to roll out very standardized, very highly templated deployments, sort of cookie cutter network deployments and configurations. And so using this tool helps also extend that model.
Yep, and it's all on GitLab. Go and get it.
Yep, go and get it. All right, we're going to wrap up with the latest financial results from HPE for Q1 of fiscal 2020. HPE reported $6.9 billion in revenue, which is down 8% year over year. We've also got breakouts of individual business segments. Their compute business, which is their biggest business unit, brought in $3 billion, down 15%. And storage, which is second business, had revenues of $1.3 billion, down 7% year over year. Sorry, compute was down 15% year over year.
Yeah, so compute's down. I mean, everything's down at HPE, 8% year over year, and the share price got a bit of a pounding. And they're basically saying that things had to get worse before they got better, and mm-hmm. they're still getting worse. They're not getting better. So mm-hmm. The share price has taken a bit of a pounding over the last couple of days, probably in line with what, you know, as the coronavirus became clear that it was going to have an impact on the share market, it's dropped a lot. So share price is down from $15 to $12, which is pretty much. But people are also predicting a lot of the analysts here. I'm looking at the analyst feeds, and they're saying that HP will missed its target, and it's also missing its revenue targets, and it's not where it needs to be. So there is some reason to believe that HPE is struggling with its business as it is. It's not getting the growth that it needed to, and particularly right. in the computer sales where it's not winning business. So they've got hard work ahead of them.
They do. So in the investor call, Antonio Neri, the CEO, said that component supply constraints disrupted their ability to meet customers' demand, and they also cited the outbreak of coronavirus impacting component manufacturing, resulting in a backlog for them, which does seem like a legitimate issue. But we know overall that trying to sell cheap servers is a tough business.
Yeah, it is. But it's also a lot of these companies run very thin supply, like they run just in time.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. so they're always going to be vulnerable to these shocks, and they never seem to they never seem to take steps to hold more stock so that this wouldn't happen, you know. Mm-hmm. So I do feel, you know, wah wah wah. And admittedly Dell had the same problem, and so has Cisco in their financial results, so it's not limited to HPE.
Not at all. Not at all. And I expect we're going to see coronavirus popping up in all kinds of results going forward. A couple of bright spots for the company. They did see growth in their high-performance compute business and their intelligent edge businesses, which were up 6% and 4% respectively, but they are just a fraction of their storage and compute businesses. Yeah. So.
Yeah, so some of your niche markets got some growth. Woo-wee. Yes, indeed.
Yeah. Okay, always look for the bright spot.
Yeah, you got to look hard for it, but found one.
Yeah. All right, well, that wraps up our news portion. Please stay tuned for our Tech Bytes conversation with ThousandEyes on its endpoint agents. That's coming right up. Welcome to Tech Bytes, a short and sweet conversation on compelling technologies and ideas in networking and IT. Our sponsor today is ThousandEyes, and we're going to discuss measuring application experience and network performance from the end user perspective. ThousandEyes agents provide visibility into the internet, WAN, and SaaS performance, but the company also offers an end user experience agent that runs directly on employees' devices, so you get a detailed view of the end user experience. Our guests today are Angelique Medina, Director of Product Marketing, and Sumana Manam, Senior Product Marketing Manager. Welcome to the show. And so just to start us off, why would I want or need to measure network performance at the client?
Yeah, so when you think about it and how just the consumption of applications has changed so dramatically, especially over the last 5 years. So there's so many more applications that are now in the cloud. So you think like Office 365 and Salesforce. But then on top of that, you have a lot of changing workforce dynamics where now users are more likely to be working from home or on mm-hmm. the road. It's kind of a double-edged sword. You know, you're not tethered to an office, but now, you know, you're kind of always on and always expected to be working. And IT has to figure out a way to support that.
And all that wonderful campus equipment that they built at the headquarters, you may not be even using.
Exactly, exactly. It's a little bit like anarchy.
So how does this end user agent work? What is it doing? Is it measuring actual app performance or running synthetic tests?
So it's doing both. You can use it either way. So if you want to understand how a user is interacting with a specific application, you could set up predefined sites or apps that you want to monitor, like Salesforce, and then when they interact with that application, you'll capture their session. Or you could just run synthetic tests, and that gives you kind of a proactive way to understand, you know, are they able to actually even just make a connection? Is the application available? And really get on top of things before a user starts to complain about it, as they will.
Mm. Yes, yes, you want to get to them before they start complaining.
Right. And I think it's also interesting to compare the difference between the user experience and sometimes what you monitor. So many of the visibility tools monitor the network, but not actually the user, right? And those two are not necessarily the same thing.
No, they're not. So you may have a user that's able to connect to an application just fine, but maybe there's something that's on the site. Maybe they're not able to log in, or there might be some component on the site that's creating a problem. And so being able to pinpoint that and know, is it the network or is it the application, just makes it so much easier to kind of figure out what your next steps are in resolving it.
And you said I can schedule these, so it's not something that's just running constantly in the background.
Yeah, exactly. So you just, you know, you just figure out, you know, some interval that makes sense just to kind of keep tabs on how the network's performing to a particular site, and then you can get alerted if there's an issue.
And are there differences between what I'm going to get from measuring a real session and a synthetic transaction?
So you'll see the synthetic transactions are really just looking primarily at the network piece. So they're not going to give you kind of detailed waterfalls or page load metrics where you might get that, or you are going to get that with a looking at the real user session. Mm-hmm. So there's some difference in kind of what you're able to see there. But there's pros and cons to kind of using both. And more typically, we find that a lot of folks are using both to understand if there's a connectivity issue, even when a user isn't going to the site. And that's, you know, again, to get ahead of issues before you hear the complaints. Right. And you can also see, you know, just a kind of add that you can look at wireless performance as well. And that can be often a kind of a wild card when it comes to figuring out issues. You know, if there's an issue with an access point, or maybe you're connecting to dodgy Wi-Fi in a hotel or an airport. And so kind of pinpointing that can be really useful.
Right. Because when a user says the network is bad, it could mean it's actually the application, it's actually the WAN, it's actually an AP somewhere.
Yeah, it can mean really anything. Yeah, for sure. Definitely the default complaint.
Well, I think it's important to understand that synthetic tests are different from the real experience. Like having an agent that's on the user's machine genuinely measures the whole thing. And synthetic tests are a little bit different sometimes because the execution is different. It's a simulation. It's that old story between what really happened and a simulation. But the flip side of this is conducting synthetic tests is simpler and cheaper and more consistent, whereas the user experience tends to be more variable. You know, just because the user agent is reporting something's wrong could also mean that the user's laptop is busted, as much as it's a networking. So you actually need to have the options to do more than one. It's not a case of one's better than the other. It depends, trademark.
Yeah, you know? Exactly. Yeah.
And so when you say you're capturing real user sessions, are you talking about packet capture or just the session interaction?
So we're not really talking about packet captures because, you know, think about it, an IT department would not be able to do packet captures for remote users.
Right.
When we say session data, what we essentially mean is we're tracking page load metrics and waterfalls that show how the web components of these pages are sequentially fetched and rendered on a page when it's loaded by the user. And this data is displayed alongside our end-to-end network connectivity metrics like packet loss, jitter, latency. And then you also have the Thousand Eyes platform's path visualization, which is essentially a blueprint of how a network is traversed. So what this allows you to do is it allows you to correlate the application performance with the network performance.
So, Simona, one of the interesting things about this is the path visualization, which is important, because what you're actually saying is you can actually track the hop-by-hop through some of the networks. It depends on the monitoring you've got in place, but you can actually see the synthetic testing or the user testing and the path that they took across the network.
Exactly, because Thousand Eyes platforms, we have the end user experience agents, but we also have the enterprise agents, we have cloud agents. So we are able to, you know, view data from different vantage points and correlate all of that.
Drill in a little bit more into what the endpoint agent is actually capturing. Am I getting local device information and also information about the local network I'm attached to?
Yes. So whether you're looking at, you know, the old user session performance or you're simply doing the network synthetic test where you're emulating a user with synthetic traffic, we show you things like CPU utilization and memory used. In addition, we also provide LAN visibility, which, you know, allows you to see the VPN gateway, the proxy. Mm-hmm. And we also give you the Wi-Fi visibility, which gives you metrics like information about the access point, the BSS ID, the access point signal quality, related data like retransmit rates, throughput, channel, a lot of useful information. Because if you think about it, in an office environment, you have multiple access points, and a user, as they, you know, traverse the office at different points, they could be connected to different access points. So the Wi-Fi health is going to vary in different areas depending on where you are in the office.
Right. Okay. That makes sense. If I'm, you know, in a meeting, in a conference room, that I may get a different wireless experience than when I'm at my desk or, you know, in the cafeteria.
Absolutely.
And if track and report on all that.
Exactly. And if you think about the remote workforce use case, you know, you're talking about consumer grade Wi-Fi at home. So you have altogether different problems at that point.
Okay. So you're actually tapping the Wi-Fi in the user's laptop and then tracking the wireless parameters. So you're tracking the BSS ID and things like that to say how much retransmission is happening in the Wi-Fi in the first hop. So you're not just capturing network information, you're actually saying I can see information because I'm capturing endpoint data.
Correct. So we're talking about from an end user's point of view, what's the first hop? It's the wireless. So we start with visibility at that point.
Okay, that makes sense. So you're collecting a lot of information on this agent. How is it getting back to Thousand Eyes for analysis? And is it going to affect how my endpoint device is performing?
Very good question. The footprint of the end user experience agent on the device is extremely light. You know, it's not meaningful CPU utilization, like less than 0.5%. And very minimal memory is needed, like maybe about 20 megabytes, which is really not all that much. So there's absolutely no impact on the performance of a user's device. Regarding the other part of your question, the data that's collected via the end user experience agent, it's consumed, it's pushed to the ThousandEyes SaaS platform. And here we can see data across all the users that have these end user experience agents deployed. So if you're talking about grouping users by function or department or geo, you know, you can do all those groupings, you can run various reports, you can score the experience of applications. You know, we have a metric called experience score, which tells you how users' experiences when a page loads. So we give you those kind of subjective metrics as well. And this is not just for like individual users, but you can also look at, you know, from an overall point of view at an aggregate, how is the application performing more broadly for all my employees at a given site?
Mm-hmm. That's important because it's the aggregate data that's also useful. So just being able to look at it by one person, sometimes it could just be their laptop, or, you know, they've got something going on, you know, whatever it is. And sometimes it could be, hang on, if everybody in the location's got a problem, that helps you know it's more likely to be the WAN connection, or it's not just, because sometimes not everybody rings up the help desk and complains. Being able to track.
Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely. Yeah, for sure. You know, and sometimes it's the entire site is performing fine, but only one end user has a problem. So, you know.
Detecting the chair to keyboard interface problem, as we used to call it. Yeah. That problem exists in the between the chair and the keyboard. That's not actually a network fault.
But it still falls to IT to solve that problem.
Exactly.
Well, yeah, meantime to innocence. So this comes down to the it's not my fault or it's not my problem. Getting to it's not my problem as quickly as possible, or it's not my fault, is actually a key part of
Absolutely.
The parameter here.
Yeah, and you know, it's also about end user productivity, so that one particular user could, you know, complain that, hey, I'm not able to get work done. IT has not resolved my issue.
Yeah. Well, the reverse condition is that there's a power user who always knows that there's something wrong and lodges the fault.
True.
And then when you confirm that everybody's got the same problem, you know that there's actually a problem. So,
So you've actually brought a couple of case studies with you as well about how customers are actually using this.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I think an interesting one that we've seen is that, you know, in particular for certain verticals like healthcare, there's kind of a broader business initiative to reduce costs and move some of the workforce to work from home. So we see this a lot with, for example, call centers or kind of help desk where part of the workforce is going to be working out of their homes. Now, from the standpoint of IT, how do they support this? You know, they have to figure out, you know, how do they maintain good productivity and connectivity to key applications over all of these consumer networks and dealing with these wildcards like, you know, wireless issues potentially. And so this has been useful for not only supporting those workers, but figuring out, you know, from the standpoint of IT, can this be supported? And we've seen some examples where, you know, running a pilot, IT has been able to say to the business that actually we can reduce the number of call centers, but we still need to maintain some in certain regions because, you know, local connectivity just maybe isn't good.
Right. Okay. So they can get be more strategic in where they're going to do work from home versus bring everybody to an office.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So really understanding, you know, because I think that, you know, a lot of visibility to the user for IT is really around kind of how do you manage the device? And that's all great. But for the folks who are managing the WAN and trying to figure out how to connect the users to applications, they really need to see the transport layer. They need to understand how the network is performing and be able to correlate that with how users are experiencing an application. And this kind of gives them that very granular network level visibility in order to do that and to tell things like, for example, is it a VPN issue that might be causing performance problems, or is it maybe the actual network underlay itself? So
right.
Yeah, that's very difficult to troubleshoot, the overlay, the underlay problem.
Yeah, absolutely.
And having any sort of data that can tell you, not so much tell you, but give you insight into where the problem might be occurring is incredibly valuable, because diagnosing it can be confusing, especially as we move to public WANs instead of private WANs and using the internet and overlay over the internet. I call that a public WAN. The variability or the change, because, you know, the internet can be fine today, but not tomorrow.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's best effort delivery. There's no SLA associated with it. I mean, things change. Routing can change. Peering relationships between service providers. So there's a lot of unknowns. It's just much more kind of subject to differences. And then when you take into account the fact that there's users could be anywhere. So now your WAN is kind of, you know, the internet at large, you know,
it's
the internet
everywhere.
At large,
yes.
It's everywhere, right? And all of the enterprise WAN endpoints are just everywhere. So this is really an interesting sort of kind of new world that IT has to deal with. And so, you know, having this kind of visibility where you're able to see effectively everywhere, well, I can see this, you know, the internet, I can see the network as if I had instrumentation there, that as if it was my own. And that's really the value, to just being able to actually manage within this environment that is just so fraught with change. And there's so much that you just simply don't own.
And you've got one more story in sort of that regard about the WAN being everywhere, of a salesperson who was complaining for months to IT about performance problems, and they just couldn't figure it out.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's sort of this kind of sales leaders on the road, you know, as a lot of sales folks are, and he had been constantly been complaining about how he wasn't able to access certain applications, and, you know, they had IT that were assigned to this, and it just kept coming up again and again, and they weren't able to resolve the issue. And they figured out later, when they finally got some visibility into the network piece, that he was actually working from a coffee shop. So it wasn't where he had said that he was, and he was tethering to his phone. And, you know, because there was some throttling going on because he was over his data limit, you know, it was causing issues where he just, the intermittent sort of quality to the disrupted experience was really due to this network piece. And they were able to see that right away. Whereas before, they were just kind of in this cycle of like, what's wrong? And let's go through this whole process of figuring out, is it the app or is it his device or is it, you know, something else? So that was really valuable for them to just immediately know what the problem was. And then, you know, that it's done, you know, no more wasted cycles.
Right. 30 seconds as opposed to 30 days.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Well, that about wraps it up for time. Angelique and Sumana, thank you for being here. And thanks to Thousand Eyes for being a sponsor. If people want to know more, where should they go?
Yes, you can go to thousandeyes.com/packetpushers to get more information. or if you'd like to start using it today to help manage an influx of remote workers, we're providing it free for 90 days. Just go to thousandeyes.com/remote.
Okay, fantastic. That's thousandeyes.com/remote. Thanks, Thousand Eyes, and thank you for listening. You can find this and many more fine, free technical podcasts along with our community blog at packetpushers.net. You can follow us on Twitter at packetpushers, find us on LinkedIn, like us on Facebook, and rate us on Apple Podcasts. And last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.